Future-proof extra.
With Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
On News Talk.
Now, for half of the human race, periods are a normal part of their lives. Approximately every 24 to 38 days, women shed the lining of their uterus, but humans are among only 2% of mammals who do this. So why do we? Dr. Jennifer Gunter is a gynecologist and author of Blood, The Science, Medicine and Mythology of Menstruation. She joins me now. Welcome to the program, Jennifer. This is, you know, a subject that thankfully we are spending a bit more time talking about now. You know, it's 2020s, but we're spending a lot more time talking about women's health. It's something that you kind of cover in the book. So I presume that this was something you felt needed a bit more exploration because of that lack of attention women's health has been getting for a century of modern science.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that is very rarely discussed in public. And certainly 10 years ago, I couldn't have imagined having an interview like this. You know, there's a lot of culture of shame about menstruation. There's a lot of misinformation. And, you know, this leads to people ending up having medical problems that they don't they're unable to get attention for. They're needless suffering. It leads to people falling down snake oil filled rabbit holes. And, you know, people should know how their body works.
Mm, absolutely. So let's start with some basic biology, because this is not something I was taught ever in school when I was growing up. I just didn't know anything about periods at all until I was probably early 20s. Truth. So what are periods and why do women have them?
Yeah, so menstruation is part of the menstrual cycle, and the menstrual cycle is, you know, the each cycle there are a group of follicles or immature eggs that are recruited. Eventually, through the hormonal changes, one of those eggs becomes dominant and it ovulates. After ovulation, the shell of the egg, if you will, the part of the follicle that's left behind, organizes into a structure called the corpus luteum, which produces progesterone. And the progesterone produces changes to the uterine lining that make it capable of implantation. And if implantation doesn't occur, the corpus luteum eventually runs out of progesterone, and that withdrawal of progesterone triggers the release of the lining, and that is menstruation. And that lining is so important, and it's so thick, it can't be absorbed because it's too thick, there's too much of it, because humans have very invasive placentas. So you need a thick lining to basically act like a backstop so the placenta doesn't go all the way through the uterus. And that thick lining has a specialized function. It's part of the immune system. And you may have heard that 70 to 80% of early, very, very early pregnancies end in miscarriage. Well, that's because that specialized uterine lining can sense abnormalities and actually trigger a miscarriage very, very early on before someone would know they were pregnant. So it's menstruation is a byproduct of needing a very thick, specialized uterine lining. And when pregnancy doesn't occur, the only way to get that lining out is to get rid of it.
I mean, it is incredible that process, the process of fertilization or not fertilization. We've done programs on it before, and it's amazing all of the things that happen to protect the fetus once there is a fetus, and all the things that happen as a result of there not being a fetus. It's really, really amazing, but it sounds really, really complicated. And I'm wondering, is it an efficient way of having babies or dealing with the need to have a fertility window? Why do women menstruate in this way?
Well, I mean, this is kind of the way that, you know, each species handles kind of converting energy from the world around it into the next generation. And because of social pressures with humans, especially the way that, you know, we've sort of evolved to live collectively, the way that, you know, we've evolved to walk on two legs, the way that we've evolved to have, you know, our big brains, all of these things are environmental pressures that push reproduction in one direction or another. And you know, so, you know, why menstruation and why not estrus, you know, is, you know, which is what most mammals have, you know, is
What is estrus?
Yeah. So estrus is what every other mammal, except the few that menstruate, have. And so estrus, there's no withdrawal of the uterine lining if pregnancy doesn't occur. So with estrus, they don't build up that thick uterine lining, because with humans, when you ovulate, you automatically build that thick uterine lining, that it's so important for humans to have that thick lining ready for the embryo. With estrus, the trigger to make those changes to the uterine lining happens by the implanted embryo. It causes that trigger. So if there's no implantation, there's no thick lining that needs to be removed. And also with estrus, there's a lot of variation amongst different animals. You know, some animals are seasonal breeders, some animals are able to, you know, reproduce multiple times during a year. There's big variations, again, related to kind of environmental pressures. And so, you know, with humans, because our incredibly invasive placenta is what, you know, allows us to have so much oxygen to help grow big brains, to, you know, help with the biological investment that's required for reproducing a human. And so this, you know, this seems to be the way that evolution decide, you know, the evolution, the twists and turns of evolution.
And evolutionary biologists are often keen to jump on some reasoning or some mechanism why things evolve. And I'm wondering, do we have any theories that sound plausible to you for why the cycle is 24 to 38 days?
Well, why it's that, I don't think we really know.
Why is it not once a year, for example, as it is in a lot of other animals?
Well, if it was just once a year, if you think about the fact that, 70% of early pregnancies would end in miscarriage, so then you'd only then be able to reproduce once every 7 years, right? Mm. And that would be enough to maintain, you know, the fertility rate, basically. So if you think about us from an evolutionary standpoint, if you're going to have so many potentially, you know, miscarried early embryos, you got to have a lot of attempts to get one, right? That's going to actually work. And then you think about the massive biological investment it takes to make a human. Pregnancy is as metabolically taxing as doing the Tour de France. Breastfeeding, incredibly metabolically taxing. And then human infants are so vulnerable to, you know, they can't even hold their head up when they're born. I mean, compare us to a giraffe that gets dropped, 5 feet is up on its legs and walking and eating, right? You know, so humans require much more investment from a parent until, you know, age 6, 7, 8, that type of thing. And so, you know, evolution wants to make sure that basically the best quality embryo has the best chance. So you're not expending all these resources for something that can't possibly run that gauntlet.
Talk to me about when things go wrong in the menstrual cycle, because you talk about this invasive placenta in a sort of judgmental sort of way. What exactly are the issues, and what conditions arise when this menstrual cycle does not go as it should?
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's the thing. Everybody thinks that, you know, Mother Nature is perfect or evolution is perfect. And, you know, evolution's motto should really be like just good enough. Mm. And so, you know, if, for example, if the lining of the uterus can't handle an invasive placenta, what happens is a condition called placenta procreta, where the placenta actually grows through the lining of the uterus and implants in the abdominal organs, which is very catastrophic.
Yeah.
Then there's, you know, menstrual conditions. So some people have very heavy periods. They lose too much blood and they get iron deficiency. Some people have painful periods over time. So the lining of the uterus is very fascinating. It was the only scarless healing in the human body. And in addition, the muscle of the uterus has to withstand a lot of trauma. So during pregnancy, as the uterus grows, you put on new muscle fibers. And then when pregnancy's over, you have to be able to get rid of some of those muscle fibers for the uterus to shrink back down. Mm. And there's a thinking that, you know, that process can go awry, and that can lead to developing benign tumors called fibroids. And, you know, by the time a woman's in her late 40s, there's a 70% chance she's got one of those tumors. And those can lead to heavy bleeding, can lead with pain with bleeding. So there's lots of things that can kind of go wrong with it.
Do we know why there's such variability in how women experience menstrual pain and you know, the heaviness of their period?
No, I mean, we obviously, you know some of the medical conditions that can cause it. So, you know, we know, for example, some people can have bleeding disorders and that can produce heavy periods. Some people can have benign tumors in the uterus and that can produce heavy periods. Some people can have endometriosis, which is a condition where the lining of tissue similar to the lining of the uterus grows outside in the pelvic cavity, and that can cause severe pain. But there are also people who don't have any of those conditions and have heavy bleeding, or don't have any of those conditions and just have a lot of pain. happening. And we don't know about that individuality and experience, but I suspect that, you know, in 20 or 30 years' time, we're going to find that there are, you know, genetic differences maybe in hormone receptors or release of hormones. You know, maybe some people release more prostaglandins, which are hormones that are produced at the site of injury and inflammation. Maybe some people produce more. Maybe some people have more attentive receptors. So, you know, I suspect down the road, we'll eventually find a reason for the uniqueness of the experiences.
There does seem to be a lot of information on the internet for women, you know, that doesn't seem to be based in science, but seems to be attributed to this idea that that everything should be natural. And this is something you kind of talk about in the book. Can you talk us through your thoughts on these so-called purity culture TikToks and so on, and the effect that they're having on women's health when it comes to things like dealing with periods and menstruation?
Yeah, I mean, I think people should know, and I don't know what the data is over here, but in the United States, a lot of these groups are funded by extreme right-wing politicians or extreme right-wing donors. So there's clearly an agenda there. So yeah, I mean, this whole sort of natural movement is really, and it's very interesting, the extreme right-wing and the extreme left-wing seem to sort of meet at this point. This idea of harking back to sort of pure, clean, natural is a very sort of old belief. You know, if you think about medicine back in the 1700s and then back further from there, medicine and religion were essentially the same or very similar. It was all about balance, right? The four humors, putting everything in balance. Balance was purity, was good. You know, you were one with God, one with nature, that type of thing. And this is really just an extension of that. And, you know, for some people it's God, for some people it's nature. They're used sort of interchangeably. And when you hear about the people talking about, oh, well, why the pill is bad for you, and they use the terms of purity culture, you think that, you know, why do you need to do that? Why do you need to use words like pure, clean, and natural? Those aren't medical words. Those aren't medical goals. What are those goals serving? Those goals are serving a religion, or they're serving some type of, you know, a
ideology.
Proxy for religion. Exactly. And so, you know, when people can't speak factually and when they're forced to speak in sort of these kinds of, you know, weird terms, you have to say, well, the reason why they can't speak factually is because they can't. I mean, the truth of the matter is the birth control pill is responsible for something like 60% of economic gains that women have had since the 1960s. So why does that bother people? Well, it bothers people if you want to keep women out of power, I suppose.
One thing that that doesn't work in science's favor is that we have sort of really overlooked women's health many times. And we've talked about this on the program many times before, that the research that goes into women's health, menstruation periods, endometriosis, menopause is absolutely a fraction of the stuff that's gone into men's health of a similar sort of population density in men. And I think that's something that we are starting to get better at, but we're still nowhere near where we need to be.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, you know, there are gaps. There are massive gaps. We have gaps in understanding of knowledge because of exactly what you said. We haven't put the money in to do the work to understand what's going on. For many of these conditions, we don't even have a great grasp of the basic biology. And so instead of helping to close those gaps, we have people coming in taking advantage of those gaps. And so, you know, two things can be true. We can have understudied women's health and people can be trying to take advantage of that. And that's what we see with sort of the anti-birth control pill agenda. You know, we see the same things about, oh, well, you can use period tracking. And, you know, the fact of the matter is that doesn't work for everybody and not everybody wants to do it. And as part of that, it also requires periodic abstinence or periodic using condoms. And again, not everybody wants to do that. And what I'm seeing in the office is people not wanting to have hormonal contraception to treat their actual medical conditions. So people who have iron deficiency and anemia, and we need to reduce their bleeding. And, you know, the best way to do that is with a hormonal birth control, and they don't want to use that option. So they may be using an option that's not working as well for them. And so there, you know, there can be real repercussions. There's people with premenstrual syndrome or premenstrual dysphoric disorder who really need the birth control pill to even out their hormones. And, you know, there's people who are afraid to try it now because of what they hear online. And I just, you know, people should just recognize that most of the all of the disinformation online about the pill, either comes from people who are well-meaning but uninformed, or from people that are actively trying to sow seeds of discontent.
And you know, it's kind of crazy that we find ourselves seeing this sort of thing, because all my life we were going in one direction in terms of greater clarity, more understanding, and it's just weird to see this sort of about face that we're seeing in areas of medicine and science and so on. It's just kind of crazy for me to think that it could go the other way, but this is where we are. It's a really interesting discussion, Jennifer. Thank you so much for your time. The book is called Blood, The Science, Medicine and Mythology of Menstruation. The best of luck with it. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Future Proof Extra
with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland
on News Talk.